Thank you for watching Conscious Consumer Network. The live stream broadcast is free to view. You can pause and rewind live broadcasts to catch up, or view shows at a later date by accessing our free archives of all shows. Check out our broadcast guide to see what's on. You can show your support by donating to our network support fund. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter, or subscribe to the monthly newsletter for updates. We thank you for supporting free and independent media.
Well, hello everyone. This is Jan Ervin and Joe Atwell. We are presenting the 35th episode of Unspun. My how time flies. I understand we are currently the most popular show on the internet and all mainstream media. Is that correct, Jan?
Well, you know, I heard that, but I'm not sure if it's true. I mean, it should be true, you know.
It should be, right, exactly, yeah. So what we're going to be talking about today is quite interesting. The Fatimans, Dorothy and James, and they are very important kind of to know from a number of perspectives, but the thing that I think is fascinating about them is they were at the very beginning of the acid test world and then have had very long careers, particularly Dorothy as a filmmaker. I mean, she's been awarded, I think, the Academy Award. She's received all kinds of accolades. And she was a neighbor of Ken Kesey on Perry Lane to sort of kind of structure this. Perry Lane was the epicenter of the MK Ultra assault on culture. In Perry Lane, you had Kesey, the Fatimans, who were one time or another kind of quasi Merry pranksters. But just 100 yards away, you had a whole cesspool of what would become the Grateful Dead. And in addition to Robert Hunter and Jerry Garcia, you had the bizarre Alan Trist, whose father was one of the founders of Tavistock. So, you know, it's almost hard to keep track of all the secret societies that were in motion at that point and were unifying into what Ken Kesey called the Combine. Or actually, they were part of the Combine. This location where they all had access to one another, they all knew each other. Basically, you began the process by which the acid tests were created. And so, Jan, I know you've done quite a bit of research into the Fatimans, particularly Dorothy.
Actually more on James than on Dorothy.
Really? Okay. Yeah. Well, how do we begin?
We should start off that Dorothy Fatiman, Joe, this may come as a real surprise to you, but she was actually one of the original Merry pranksters.
Good heavens.
And not only that, but she was lovers of Ken Kesey. And so we're right back in the same little nexus of people that we're always discussing. And, you know, she also makes Agenda 21 films, apparently, at least that's what it looks like from my opinion, for the UN. And she works with Westwood Creek Productions. They are, Westwood Creek Productions is the organization that put out the propaganda film in 2011 called Thrive, and that's T-H-R-I-V-E. But, Westwood Creek Productions has promoted the likes of Bob Dylan, Crosby, Stills, and Nash, Grateful Dead, et cetera. I think it's owned by Stephen Gagné. But that is who Dorothy Fatiman is. She also influenced the writing of the Aquarian conspiracy book. Whoops, and I didn't put it in front of me. That we did a show on, and you and I have done shows on it, Steve Outram and I, Hans and I, we've all talked about this Aquarian conspiracy book that came out of the SRI, Changing Images of Man. Now, the Changing Images of Man book that we've talked about in the past so much from Stanford Research Institute. Well, her current husband, who is Dr. James Fadiman, is one of the original contributors, Joe, to Changing Images of Man. So, you know, he's actually listed in the book, and I don't have the page right in front of me, but he's right here, in fact, right there on the up, right there about halfway down. There's James Fadiman right there. But so James Fadiman is one of the original contributors to this big mind control operation that we see being rolled out on society. And he's one of the conspirators that they talk about in, well, they both are in the Aquarian conspiracy. But James Fadiman, Joe, you may not believe this, but James Fadiman just happens to be the very last doctor allowed to dispense legal LSD in the United States.
Yeah, I've heard that. How did he get that privilege, I wonder?
Well, you know, that's a really good question. Now, I've met James Fadiman, and I had him on the show back on in July of 2010, and I met him at the MAPS conference up in San Jose. And he seemed like a nice guy, and this was before I knew that, that most of MAPS and all of that was working with the intelligence community, or was the intelligence community. And so I had him on the show to discuss his work, especially in his book, The Psychedelic, I think, I'm not sure if the book was published then, but his book, The Psychedelic Explorer's Guide. So this is his book. The subtitle is Safe, Therapeutic, and Sacred Journeys. And of course, we've covered how they manufactured the sacred journey aspect, discussing the conversation between Tim Leary and Oscar Janiger in the 1979 reunion party video that we did a show on. But they state that the spiritual experience was a California invention, and then Tim Leary is laughing and he says, yes, that's right. But so James Fadiman was in the middle of all of this, and his wife was one of the original Mary Pranksters. Now, James Fadiman also worked with Dr. Willis Herrmann, who was at SRI. He's another one of these people that I've worked to expose a lot, another big agent. But and I'm going to bring this up on the screen here, and this is just some of the connections here, but James Fadiman is also working with the Esalen Institute. He was a one of the, you know, he preaches all this spirituality, but interestingly, he was a consultant for Lockheed Martin missiles and things like this, and his curriculum vitae is up here on the website, and we can go through here and we can see, like, you know, all of the different things that he's worked for, the Crosby Trust, but let me see if I can find Lockheed on here. And so we see Dow Chemical, Lockheed Space and Missiles right here, and right where it's highlighted there. But, you know, this is, you know, your spiritual on one side, and then helping the people who make the weapons of mass destruction on the other side. We can also see that he was trustee of the Cosby Trust in Palo Alto. And of course, all of this stuff seems to center around Palo Alto. But, you know, his whole curriculum vitae is up here in the brain database if people would like to check that out. He's also one of the original creators of transpersonal psychology, transpersonal education. So this goes, they're trying to create all of this new spiritual, psychology. So it's transpersonal psychology, just like all of the other trans stuff we've been exposing. But Joe, here's another thing that you might find of a bit of interest. This guy, James Fadiman, he dosed somebody you may have heard of by the name of Stuart Brand.
Wow, I wonder how these two comets in existential space ran into one another.
Well, Joe, it must have been serendipity.
Yeah, I guess another circumstance. I just wanted to point out, just to sort of give some fleshing out to what Jan was saying. We, at this point in our show, we sort of presume that a lot of the audience is aware that basically that Ken Kesey has been outed as an agent, and that MK Ultra has been outed as a containing a project within it to debase our culture. And I'm specifically referring to the evidence that we have, which should every citizen should be aware of, that Gordon Wasson's trip, which begins the psychedelic revolution, was in fact MKUltra sub-project 58. And I'm proud to announce, John, that after all of the battles and struggles we've had with Wikipedia, we now have a stable citation of Wasson's trip. The entire trip is being described as sub-project 58 of MKUltra on Wikipedia.
Wow.
And I just want to tell you that that was the result of heroic efforts by Jerry Russell, who just fought every assault against the truth into the dust. And, you know, to win these battles, it just takes a long time, a lot of precision. And we now have that. Now, what this does is that we can now spread out. We can actually use this as a platform for informed speculation. Willis Harriman, who James Fadiman has worked with, and the whole Changing Images of Man project is also outed. The linkages are completely direct and straightforward into the MKUltra organization. And once MKUltra has been outed, then a lot of these organizations that were just, you know, curiously debasing culture at every turn can now be identified as just part of the overall op. Specifically the Stanford Research Institute, and also Willis Harman and the Changing Images of Man component. So really want to invite everyone to go into the brain, see the associations, and see how you can actually build out the social network that produced this cultural abomination. What's interesting, and which is also and is also quite sad, is that Fadiman is still at it.
He's absolutely still at it.
Right. And so, you know, he had this amazing circumstance whereby he was the last person able to do legal LSD experiments. I mean, just imagine the connections that he has to have into the government and into, you know, intelligence to be able to have such a privilege. But he has been one of the people who'd been advocating what Jan and I want really to draw attention to as something that is very dangerous and at worst and very, very stupid at best, and that is this new microdosing. Now, microdosing basically is simply taking very small amounts of LSD and then you know, having normal life. It's being used by a lot of people in the tech world and in San Francisco almost on a daily basis, right? I know this from direct testimony of people who are engaged in it. So they take small doses, perhaps 1/10 of the normal amount, but then they use it as a kind of stimulant. Well, you know, when you expose Fadiman and expose his wife's connection into the Merry Pranksters and the Pranksters' relationship to Kesey, and then suddenly, you know, the MKUltra project is visible in all of their work, you can see that you really need to look at Fadiman's suggestion that everyone takes LSD, you know, a small time, you know, in small doses, as very dangerous. And basically, it's just a continuation, don't you think, Jan? I mean, isn't he just simply carrying on with the work that Kesey and Jerry Garcia and Gordon Wasson began?
Yeah, I would agree with that, Joe. And, you know, for that matter, the CIA and MI6 as a whole. But, you know, I should let everybody know that back in 2010, James Fadiman was doing illegal underground LSD tenor studies, T-E-N-E-R studies, and he had asked me to participate in one of his studies, which I did very briefly, and I got sick. But basically what a tenor is, and we discussed this in my July, it was released on July 4, 2010, but we discussed this in that interview about microdosing and tenors, back then I was unaware of all of the, again, unaware of all of the intelligence connections with these people. And I didn't realize that Fadiman was working with the intelligence community and SRI and all of this stuff. And so I volunteered to participate in this illegal underground LSD study that he was running. And
amazing.
Amazing. And so I was the one report apparently in the this tenor study of the person who got really sick doing it. But basically what a tenor is he's going around in this microdosing idea, is that he's going around promoting the idea that you're going to have more increased perception and problem solving, et cetera, if you do microdoses of 10 micrograms rather than like your average dose of LSD, like 100 micrograms. And so with this tenor idea, and I think looking back, it's probably a lot more geared toward just creating a little bit of hyper, you know, suggestibility, Joe. And,
right.
Rather than a full dose, they can just increase people's hyper suggestibility ever so slightly and keep it, going on a low level like that.
So that's what the tenor project is. It means it refers to 10 micrograms of LSD.
Or 10%. Yeah. And, let me just show this up here on the screen. In fact, here's a photograph of me and Dr. James Fadiman and from 2010 here. And so, and right here we'll be discussing LSD tenors and psychedelic problem solving studies. And then, just to give a little bit on his background, James Fadiman, born in May 1939, Fadiman received a BA from Harvard in social relations in 1960. So he was actually part of Henry A. Murray's social relations department at Harvard.
Good heavens.
That we saw Leary coming out of, and Dick Price and Theodore Kaczynski, the Unabomber. Well, he was actually a victim of these guys.
He
at
was
Harvard.
A victim of it, right, yeah.
And, of course, everybody knows that Theodore Kaczynski became the Unabomber. But what many people don't know is that they targeted these people that did, the Unabomber targeted these people that did these experiments on him at Harvard. But the Harvard Social Relations Department, if I can just find it here. Here it is. We see Henry A. Murray there. B.F. Skinner comes out of the same department. And, of course, B.F. Skinner created the Skinner box and operant conditioning and all of this stuff. There we can see his face there. Michael Hollingshead, who also created the psychedelic revolution in England and London, was there. We also see Dick Alpert or Ram Dass in that same department. And, of course, Aldous Huxley was also working with the people in that department at Harvard. But another important figure out of that department is Ralph Metzner. And, of course, Ralph Metzner worked with Timothy Leary. He was working at the Millbrook Mansion, helping them run these human experiments out of the Millbrook Mansion. Of course, I've gone to the Millbrook Mansion, shown pictures of it, et cetera, in the last few months. But this is who... this is the core group of people that was actually coming out of that Harvard Social Relations Department that essentially kicked off the whole MKUltra thing. Now, Dick Price, he died, apparently a rock fell and hit him on the head when he was meditating at the Esalen Institute. But Dick Price, when he left Harvard, he actually became, Joe, one of the original founders of the Esalen Institute with Michael Murphy.
Amazing that a rock fell on his head. Kind of far-fetched, if you ask me.
I always thought I wonder if he started questioning the official story and was going to expose it. But I was always told the official story was that he was meditating in a cave and under a cliff edge in the rain, and a rock fell right on his head and killed him.
These things happen. So when Fadiman approached you to be a research volunteer, what was the actual invitation about? What did he tell you about it? What did he suggest it was going to do? Why did you then think it was a good idea?
Well, you know, of course, as you know, I was into psychedelics back then, and I was just beginning to wake up to, you know, I had figured out by then that the Gordon Wasson was MKUltra, but at the time, I still thought it was just Wasson. I didn't realize that, you know, that most of our well-known psychedelic heroes were working for the intelligence community. And then, you know, at the time, here's this last guy able to do legal LSD studies in the United States. And he, you know, he talked to me about, I can't remember, I think it was at MAPS, or we had, you know, a number of phone conversations afterward. And, you know, I would call him at his home and talk to him sometimes. But basically, he wanted to study problem solving and creation building, you know, creative arts building through these tenor studies, you know, and he, you know, how he was getting around the legal issues of doing the studies was he was recommending people do 10th of a dose of street LSD, not like, you know, LSD 25 or something like that from Sandoz or from Eli Lilly. But this was just street stuff, and you had to acquire it on your own. And, you know, I had done LSD a number of times, and I've been accused on the show, you know, he's never even tried this stuff. How can he say, you know, I've actually done mushrooms and LSD and peyote and most of the other stuff several times each, more than that, actually. But at the time, I thought it was a good thing, and so I decided to participate. I only did it for a few days before I got sick, and I let him know about it, and he, called him up and told him about it. And then when I started figuring this stuff out, I think it was in 2013 or 2014, I exposed what he was involved in, on Facebook. And he and I got into a big debate on Facebook, and he used the typical sophist slander and spin and all of this stuff. And he was writing people in the background, telling them nonsense about me, you know, like, you know, sending private messages to people in the thread and stuff like this, trying to control and direct the conversation from behind the scenes, which wasn't working well for him. And, you know, he says, oh, you know, I mostly studied theater at Harvard. You know, what kind of agent would do that? And I, you know, I just made a crack at him that, well, of course, you know, we've never seen agents study acting before. I mean, you know, lifetime actors, right?
Yeah, right, exactly, yeah.
I mean, it's your atypical agent background, social relations and theater acting, this kind of stuff. So, and then he removed himself and blocked me. But people, you know, that are on the Facebook page, they can go back and search the history and find this debate between Dr. Fadiman and I. But you know, it was a lot of name calling and this kind of nonsense. And I've called him out a number of times and tried to bring attention to him. But, you know, we've been seeing the promotion of this microdosing in the media lately and on shows like
Dave Asprey, actually getting some publicity as like some kind of viable lifestyle.
Right. Yeah. You know, in fact, somebody even brought this up to me this morning about how, you know, wonderful this idea was. And I hear about this all the time. Now they're also using MDMA or ecstasy for microdosing, and there's a whole history behind MDMA and who promoted that. And, you know, it's actually Rick Doblin at MAPS who went to MAD, Mothers Against Drunk Drivers, and had ecstasy outlawed in the 80s, and then he founded MAPS to then make it legal again. So a good old Hegelian dialectic there with him right in the middle to be able to be ahead of the organization legalizing the drug. And then, of course, Rick Doblin was under, Michael Kleiman, another Harvard professor in the John F. Kennedy School of Law there at Harvard. And Kleiman, he's got some really famous quotes, Mark A.R. Kleiman. You know, he wrote this paper and they tried to remove it when I brought attention to it, and I luckily grabbed a copy before I went public with it. But and some other people were trying to expose him as well. But Mark A.R. Kleiman, he says, again, it may be possible to target counter narcotics specifically against the insurgency by selective enforcement that effectively tolerates pro-government traffickers and corrupt officials. And this is a paper that he did on who they would support in Afghanistan. And let me just show this on screen here. Hold on just a second.
That's quite amazing.
Actually. Yeah. So, you know, so this is all these guys, but, you know, Mark A.R. Kleiman, here he is. But Rick Doblin actually worked directly under Mark A.R. Kleiman. Now, Mark A.R. Kleiman, he worked with, or he was the professor of another famous guy by the name of William Leonard Picard. Now, William Leonard Picard is famous because he's the guy that was running that big missile silo that they found where they were manufacturing all of the LSD. So that was you know, Rick Doblin's professor, Mark A.R. Kleiman. I mean, you know, Rick Doblin and Leonard Picard very likely went to school together, and I do show them as related here, knowing each other. But again, he's the one that went and had LSD outlawed and then founded MAPS to make it legal again. So, you know, and Rick Doblin is also the same guy that did the follow-up study on Timothy Leary's Good Friday experiment. Now, again, years ago on my show, back before I knew who these guys were, I interviewed them. And so we'll also find Rick Doblin as show number 10, way back at the very beginning, December 22nd, 2008, which was about, 2 months after I launched the show. So, you know, I interviewed this guy, and he's the one behind all of this and getting LSD legal and relaunching all of the clinical studies and all of this stuff. So, anyway, going back, it was through, you know, James Fadiman and through these guys that all of this stuff sort of happened. And it was at the MAPS conference where I met James Fadiman, where he got me into this tenor study. And so the rest is history from there, essentially.
Yeah, you know, what's fascinating is that when you identify an agent, and obviously Fadiman's connection suggests this, his wife being a prankster, right? His being the last legal researcher into LSD. And then, of course, his advocacy of the microdosing. I mean, these are aspects of the op against the operation against culture. I mean, so it's very suspicious. But then what really seals the deal is this constant pattern that we see just over and over and over again, is that once you expose someone, once someone is analytically exposed as being someone in the op, and then you look at this, which is done basically through their activity, through their direct action, you know, you say, so you identify them. But then when you look into the social connections, suddenly you're just right back into the world that we've exposed. And so this is another trademark, something that people need, a tool, an analytic tool, that when you see all of these social connections all leading back to the Merry Pranksters, to MAPS, to Willis Harmon and the, you know, the changing images of man, to SRIs, when you see that vast connection into all of these different organizations that have been shown to be dirty, then you have another basically something that is not circumstantial. I mean, it's analytic evidence, you know, that this person is, through the actions and through the social connections, can be basically regarded as someone in the operation. And this goes to underline how important the brain is, because the brain is really the first tool the public has had to be able to see, to visualize the social connections. If you don't have it, you wouldn't know that they would even exist, because you might see, it's interesting that Fadiman knows Willis Harriman, but that isn't going to mean much if you don't know who Harriman is, and you don't know who Harriman knew, who Harriman connected to. So we show their actions, and then we show the social connections to basically a whole universe of agents and presumed agents. And so this is how the public can basically learn about their history. They can learn the individuals that did produce this operation, and you can see the institutions they came out of, you know. So that's really wonderful stuff, and I hope everyone takes this this journey. You know, start with Fadiman and just work backwards, and you know, you'll see the network that actually created the attack against against culture. You know, I was I was actually doing an interview last week, and you know, someone asked me about the research that I did connecting the American Jewish Committee into MK Ultra and into the Macy Conference, and they asked me how did I do it? You know, how was this connection hadn't been made for? What, how did you do this? And I said, well, it's pretty simple. I simply worked backwards. You know, I just worked backwards in terms of time, trying to trace the ideas and the ideas of cultural control and of using Eros and drugs and things to basically have the same effect on our culture that the Nazis attempted with a very draconian mind control. The version that we got in the States, you know, had the calling card of what they referred to as Eros, you know, sexuality, unbridled sexuality, do what thou wilt, you know, drugs and music. So this was a whole different approach than you've seen in other totalitarian societies, but it had the same goal. It was definitely attempting to control our minds. And so the tool of the social connections just can't be underestimated, and really hope everyone attends Gnostic Media and learns how to use the brain, because you can see not just who the individuals were, but who the group was.
Yeah, and I can show people here. I get a lot of emails, where is the brain on the website? And if people just go to the Gnostic Media website, they'll find it right here on the top menu. Just click on the brain. And you can download the software there from the company, and it's got a short little instructions here on how to read the information on the database. And you can also access the online version of the database right there, so you don't have to download it if you don't want to or don't have the space. But it's pretty much the same. It's a little bit easier to use on the non-website version here. But the website version has everything there, and you can go in and read everything and study it. But it's pretty simple. You know what? What I should do is just give a little explanation here so that people can understand a little bit better.
Yeah, but, that's a great idea. Yeah, so let's see.
With the brain, okay, so let's go back to James Fadiman. So, you know, for instance, down here on the bottom, we see things that James Fadiman directly influenced or had control over. So he dosed, for instance, Stuart Brand. So he influenced Stuart Brand. He also was one of the founders of the Institute of Transpersonal Psychology. His daughter is Maria Fadiman. So these are below him. He was also one of the co-authors of the Changing Images of Man, also influenced the Aquarian Conspiracy. He also helped influence the creation of the Institute of Noetic Sciences, which we see all of the typical players there. And here's John D. Marks, in fact, who wrote The Search for the Manchurian Candidate, who's the assistant to the director of the Bureau of Intelligence and Research.
Right.
But you know, so these are things basically directly created by or influenced by the center concept here. Okay, and then over to the far left here, we see people that Fadiman knew, such as he knew Wernher von Braun. And he also knew Marilyn Ferguson, that wrote the Aquarian Conspiracy. And he knew Ken Kesey. Of course, he married Ken Kesey's girlfriend. He knew Albert Hofmann. You know, and some of them are tagged here. It says friends, married to... Wernher von Braun says possible relationship. So there's a chance that he didn't know him directly, but I have it marked there as possible relation there. Now, above are things that directly influenced the center concept here. So up above, we have, you know, agent or asset, CIA, Dow Chemical, which we saw in his CV, Encyclopedia Britannica. He spent a lot of time and worked with the Esalen Institute, Federal Home Loan and Bank, Harvard University is where he went to school, so they influenced him. He also worked for Hewlett-Packard, worked for the Journal of Humanistic Psychology, worked for Lockheed, which we already showed. He was apparently, in my opinion, it's clear that he was one of the MKUltra doctors. He was also influenced by Ram Dass or Richard Alpert, who was also at the Harvard Social Relations Department. And I believe he also went to San Francisco State University, or he worked there. But these are all things that directly influenced, you know, the center concept here. And then over to the far right here, these are basically, and we see Alan Triss right here, but these are basically third hand, not these bottom, not the bottom one, Stuart Brand there, but from I forget, one of those, it looks like Alfred Gordon Hamer right there on upward. These are all just third hand citations that relations that the database pulls up. Usually you won't find too much of value over here because they're third hand versus first and second hand citations and relations, but sometimes you'll find interesting correlations over here in the third hand stuff. Hopefully that makes it more clear.
Yeah, that is that's fascinating, and it is actually quite logical how you've structured it all once people start using it. So what you have there is a tool, and the issue with Fadiman shows how the tool can be used. You know, this is a way we can like place Fadiman in social structure and in personal relationships and also in projects.
You know, Joe, there is something I forgot to mention in my interview with Fadiman. He talks about being, of course, and a lot of this was part of DARPA and ARPANET and SRI, et cetera, but he was behind the creation of the computer. And one of the things that he told me that he helped to invent was this little gadget right here called a computer mouse.
Yeah, so that people could be really wired in directly into the...
So that way, yeah. It was the first interaction other than the keyboard between the... You know, the human or reality world and the cyber world, essentially, or the computer world.
Right. So, you know, this is how we got here, folks. The brain is what we need to do to basically identify the people and the projects that have led to the sorry state the culture's in at the moment. But Jan, getting back to the microdosing. You're only able to do it for a few days. You got sick. The street LSD is just that toxic.
Well, and I probably must have gotten whiff of a flu bug at the same time. And then LSD does deplete your immune system. And I got wiped out.
Right.
You know, and I was kicking and throwing up for several days. And,
I really think that, there needs to be, and I don't know how you do the experiments, but with LSD, the stuff that Fadiman's advocating, I really think it does make people sick. I mean, I think if you do microdosing of LSD a number of times, because there are people now in San Francisco and in the tech world that are taking it five times a week.
Sure. And it's because of primarily Fadiman's promotion of it. Right.
Right. Exactly. And so I would think that the long term effect of this would just be to make someone very, very suggestible.
I would think so too, but yet in a slow way, so that it, you know, it's not the big shock like a, you know, 100 or several hundred microgram dose of LSD or MDMA or whatever, but it's a slow, subtle way to do it where you're slowly increasing the hypersuggestibility of the person. And I do recommend people read my article, you know, Enthugens, What's in the Name, because this article is key to understanding how they marketed and promoted the so-called spiritual experience. And again, earlier in the show, we discussed Timothy Leary and Oscar Janiger cracking jokes about how the whole thing was a California invention. And that's because, as the article breaks down and explains, the drugs cause hypersuggestion, and I call them suggestogens for this very reason.
Right.
But before, when they were called psychotomimetic and schizophrenogens, nobody had ever had a spiritual experience. So as soon as the drugs were renamed, that's when the spiritual experiences began to be reported. It wasn't until the invention of the name psychedelic. And then, you know, Timothy Leary, Agent Timothy Leary is accused of ruining the name, and they had to come up with a new name. And so then, psychedelic was created by Humphrey Osmond and Abram Hoffer and Aldous Huxley. And then Team 2, which was Gordon Wasson, Dr. Carl Ruck, Jonathan Ott, Jeremy Bigwood, etc., created the word entheogen to market the drugs in a new way. So now they had the word entheogen out there. And entheogen, it means to generate God within. Okay, so they're telling people the type of experience that they should have. Again, it goes back to hypersuggestibility. When they were called psychotomimetics, people had experiences that mimicked psychosis. When they were called schizophrenogens, people had experiences mimicking schizophrenia. So this is all about hypersuggestibility. Again, I highly recommend people read this article. If you've read it before, read it again, because it's really important to understand exactly how the drugs were misrepresented. A lot of people will say, well, you know, mushrooms existed, peyote existed long before the CIA, so therefore this can't be correct. Well, that's untrue. We can actually, if people read the article in the work, they'll see that even Maria Sabina, where Gordon Wasson discovered the mushrooms from, that she came out in 1981 in a book with Alvaro Estrada trying to expose Wasson, and she stated very clearly that before Wasson, nobody had used the mushrooms for spiritual experience or to find God, that it only happened after Wasson came. Wasson manufactured that religion, and not only that, but you can go into the Florentine Codex from Father Sahugan from the 16th century and read all of the original reports, and you can see that Wasson and John Allen and all of these other so-called scholars misrepresented all of the accounts in the 16th century reports, and that most of the reports reveal, and I am working on a paper to expose all this, but most of the quotes there reveal that the mushrooms were used to prep people for human sacrifice and suicide. And so Wasson went in there and then remarkets them as a spiritual experience. So again, they create hypersuggestion in the taker. So whatever the programmer wants you to believe, this is basically what's going to happen. So you might even consider psychedelics to be sort of a reprogramming tool. If you were to try to reprogram a computer, think of the software or whatever that you're reprogramming a computer with, this is basically what psychedelics or entheogens or schizophrenogens do, is they make the person hyper suggestible. So in the article, entheogens, what's in a name, I even created a new term for this called suggestogens or sugerogens, a substance or substances formerly known as hallucinogens, psychedelics, entheogens, schizophrenogens, psychotomimetics, psychotropics, psychoactives, adaptogens and pathogens, fantasticants and actogens, psychotolytics, and many other various names that have been used to historically suggest a person to someone else's will, often to do evil, while under the influence of such substances which generate hypersuggestibility in the taker. Hypersuggestibility is so increased by such substances that their mere name can affect the outcome of the experience. And hence suggestogens.
Right. That's actually a very important correction in our vocabulary, because you're right. Psychedelic was just a very clever way to market basically substances that they knew produced psychosis. And the attribute of the psychosis they were trying to produce was a suggestibility, so that then turn on, tune in, drop out concept could be basically absorbed. And that's why, and the fact that, you know, you referenced the fact that Fadiman may have been an MKUltra doctor. Well, I actually believe that as well. I think I can't actually prove it. I don't have the citation, but
right. But there's a hell of a lot of evidence to make
enough evidence. I also, because I know how the op works, I would say my opinion, the chances are basically 100%. So I'm just going to say that when Fadiman contacted you about, you know, microdosing, I think he was still basically under the auspice of MK Ultra. I think he was still
very possible, right?
Trying to do experiments, and I think that.
Think of how since that time in 2010 till now, how popular this nonsense idea of microdosing in tenors has gotten.
Absolutely, and
LSD so and
I would just hope that people who listen to the show and think that this is worrisome will help promote to the public, and particularly those that are engaged in the practice, that they could actually be subjects in an experiment, that what they could be doing is looking, trying to determine what are the long-term effects of small doses of LSD in terms of both psychosis and suggestibility as like a subset of psychosis. And so I would think the chances of that are really high. And one of the reasons why we're taking the show to expose all this is because we are dealing with an odd going situation. We're dealing with microdosing coming from Fadiman, Fadiman's connections into MKUltra and to the military op against culture are fairly well established. So it would be a great moment, a great act, to start having a public awareness of the fact that this could be an MKUltra experiment that's going on.
It's a very high likelihood.
Yeah, we would have to vet it very carefully. But first of all, the practice is dangerous and stupid and just should be stopped. And second, it would be fascinating to see what would happen if the people who are taking it to a large fraction of them became aware that they were actually being experimented on. They would, I think, hopefully, do the right thing and try to organize and expose more of what MKUltra has done and is doing, and also help alert the public that we've just got to stop taking these crazy psychotic producing drugs.
Indeed. Yeah, you know, what I wanted to do was go back for a second. You know, we should, you know, probably discuss, I don't know if you have anything to add, and hopefully I'm going to have more to add about this soon, but we should probably talk a little bit more about Dr. Ted Kaczynski. Now, Ted Kaczynski, of course, he's in prison in Colorado now. He used to be in prison out in the Mojave Desert here in California. But Ted Kaczynski was one of their victims at Harvard. And it appears that Ted Kaczynski, now he wrote the Unabomber Manifesto. And the Unabomber Manifesto exposed all of the transhumanism and all of the stuff that's going on. And Ted Kaczynski's biggest mistake, Joe, was that rather than, I mean, he was a brilliant professor. He worked at Berkeley. He was a professor of mathematics at Berkeley. And the guy was just completely brilliant, but they really tortured him and destroyed his life there at Harvard. Apparently these same groups of people. Now, I don't know if James Fadiman did this stuff to Kaczynski himself, but certainly, you know, people in that department did. Now, what it appears, though, is that Kaczynski specifically targeted those working with MKUltra and SRI and was trying to stop the spread of the internet and transhumanism, et cetera. But his biggest mistake was not going public and trying to expose it, but simply trying to blow these guys to smithereens. And so rather than using an exposure technique, he became the bad guy that they were then able to parade around the media and who's still considered this evil, dark guy today, even though, you know, in a weird, twisted sense, Ted Kaczynski was the hero of the whole story.
Kaczynski is fascinating. He is someone that I study quite a lot. And, I don't know any longer if I believe his story. I think that, you know, they always have, you know, a way to manipulate people away from sort of the core problems and the core individuals and programs that are going on. Kaczynski's behavior, and particularly the fact that he didn't come public, it seems that his actual effect on society has just been to make whistleblowers basically look like Kaczynski as people who might be insane.
In his defense, though, Joe, we have to remember that they did horrific experiments.
Absolutely, and he could easily be just
here he is at Harvard, you know, right. And then here he is, you know, and then this is the photo that they parade around to make him look completely insane. But they did drive him to the point of insanity. They did break him at Harvard.
Well, there's one way to try to find out if this is an op, and it could be actually done. It's mechanically possible. One of the people who he sent bombs to was basically a computer programmer, worked with Brand. I forget his name. But he had his hand destroyed, and he always appears in public with a glove like Dr. Strangelove, you know, in the movie.
Wow.
But it has been pointed out by a few people who've studied it that the movements he has with the hand looks as though he's actually has not been damaged, that he simply wears a glove. And so since this individual exists, you know, if you could basically take the glove off and look at his hand and see if he's simply a lifetime actor, that might be really interesting evidence. But, you know, the thing is that, you know, when you deal with the organization, you're dealing always with lifetime actors. You know, they always have a cover story. So the image that we get in the press, this image of reality and of personalities, you know, you just have to have some room set aside for suspicion. I mean, I think it's very likely that he's just as he represents. That's probably the most likely. But some doubt has crept into my mind, I have to admit that.
Well, sure. You know, and you always have to have doubt, but yes.
Yeah. So anyway, so that's just where I am with him, but it's his story should be studied, but not because of his activity or the manifesto, but because he was basically a product of the experiments that the military intelligence and psychological community, that combine, was running against the American population during this era. So the thing that I just don't get is why he didn't go public. If you're going to target them, if you're going to attempt to bomb them, and then if you're going to all the trouble of writing the manifesto, which seems to indicate a pretty clear mind. You know, he doesn't seem to be in any way delusional in the manifesto, but it doesn't take you to the right place. It doesn't take you to the right people. And so could the manifesto have been?
Well, I have heard that there are actually at least three different versions of the manifesto.
Right, I've heard the same thing, yeah. So it'd be interesting to know about this, but maybe it's just, maybe he's as real as can be and they've just taken on his image. You know, they've created a new manifesto.
Sure. Now, we also have to remember, Joe, regarding his sanity, is that he was professor of mathematics at Berkeley for I don't remember what it was, a decade or whatever. So he was actually a normal functioning guy.
Right.
But, you know, again, there is all of this evidence that shows that he was targeting those involved with MKUltra and with the Stanford Research Institute.
Exactly. Yeah. And so if they're trying to, you know, create a kind of a very complicated cover for those agencies by seemingly having them attacked by a mad person, then that would, you know, it just, this is what we're dealing with. Once we saw MKUltra for what it was, you know, and for what it is today, I don't think it's ever been vetted or in any way slowed down. It's really hard to believe anything that comes through the mainstream media. The the blogs and the podcasts that have come out on the internet in the last 10 years are really, honestly, the first real expression of free minds since probably before World War One. You know, so you know, the one thing that we need to do, of course, is present skepticism. And we don't want it to paralyze us and just think, well, everything is, you know, basically fake. And, you know, what can you do? We just have to steadily and calmly work toward communion with one another and, you know, develop the facts. They've made so many mistakes. You know, it's not just Gordon Wasson's pay requisition. It's not just the fact that they lumped all the agents together at Perry Lane and the chateau there in Menlo Park before the op again. And it's not just that they introduced Alan Trist, whose father was, you know, the head of the Tavistock. There are thousands of mistakes they've made. And so we can now, particularly with the brain, we can work backwards and expose
each other. And the trivium, right.
Yeah, exactly. And so that's why when you see Fadiman producing, you know, this microdosing phenomena, and then you work backward to when he was a resident. You know, Fadiman actually lived at Perry Lane. Did you know that?
Yeah, I knew that Dorothy did. You're saying that James did also. Interesting.
Right. Well, so this isn't.
Certain. I mean, this is just. The coincidence meter.
Right. It's just a process. I mean, once you've got MK Ultra wired into this group with Hunter and Kesey's employment. And once you got their relationship to Wasson's MK Ultra employment, the whole lot of them are convicted in my mind. And so, you know, okay, so now go forward to today and you say, okay, Fadiman is still at it. He's still doing damage and it's up to the public to stop him, expose him. We're going to invite him to come on the show for an interview if he doesn't, you know, like what we're saying. We're certainly happy to have
absolutely
him on.
yeah James, you know, Jim, you're welcome to contact me or Joe. I'm sure you still have my email address. Send me an email if you'd like to come on the show,
old
and
we'll
be glad to allow you to give your side of the story. And we request that you don't use any Harvard social relations spin like you did in our debate on Facebook, etc.
We're not big fans of that.
No gaslighting and all of these other techniques that you tried before. But, you know, we're interested in a point-by-point discussion, and we welcome you to come on if you're, you know, if you're willing to stand up for yourself.
Right. I mean, and of course, we haven't heard from Dennis McKenna, who we also made the offer to have on the show. You know, I am still angry with him for his just ludicrous sophistry. I mean, I've gone over the interview that he did where he attacked you, and every time I do it, irks me more because I just see more and more tricks and basically, you know, sophistry where he's just twisting logic incredibly. And so,
and then attacking me for twisting the logic.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And so, right, like pointing out that Eslon, you know, had a connection into the CIA, but then also making claims like, well, to claim that every single person that went to Eslon, and like, of course, the obvious response is, well, where does Jan say this? Please produce the citation, you know.
Sure.
So it's he's a sophist. He's probably, I would say the odds are very high.
I actually had an old friend of mine attack me for the same thing this week because he studied massage there. And he's like, oh, Eslon isn't CIA. You know, right. I studied massage there. You know, former friend who started a spiritual retreat down in Peru, and I called him out on all the stuff, but he didn't like that. So now he's out slandering me, even though we were friends for 12 years.
Well, they're changing the op. I mean, they've seen that these things are outed, you know, the Bohemian Grove and Eslon are outed.
Yeah, and they're quickening things too.
Right. And so what they're doing is like Bohemian Grove now is having a welcome to the public day where non-members can come. Right. I'm serious. They actually have set this up. So now, you know, and they hand out owl hats so that the publics can all think of themselves. I mean, I'm not kidding. This is actually going on. But it's obviously just a way to camouflage, you know, what the organization is.
It's to put a pretty, you know, smiley face on the organization.
Because they're being exposed.
Look, we're inviting the public up now. We're not so bad. We're the good guys.
You can be a junior Bohemian Grove member. just like the Freemasons did. It's always the same pattern where the inner core is cut off from the rest of the organization, which somehow by these levels of top secrecy and need to know whatnot. But in any case,
we only have a few seconds left here, Joe.
All right, buddy. Well, hey, buy Caesar's Messiah, Shakespeare's Secret Messiah. Go to the website, caesarsmessiah.com and postslaviana.org. And Jan, people should go to Gnostic Media, don't you think?
I think they should, and they should also, you know, support the show, make donations. We can't do it without donations. They should also support CCN. Again, a donation to CCN is not a donation to you or I. Each is independent. Right. Donations to you and donations to myself are also independent. But yeah, please support the network, support the show, buy the books, get a membership for the website. And thank you so much, and right. See you next week.
Bye-bye, everybody.
Conscious Consumer Network was designed to create a live broadcast TV network for free and independent media and has been live on the air since the 1st of January 2015. CCN gets millions of minutes watched every month and is viewed in over 140 countries, having produced around 1,400 shows and counting.
And you know, it's very hard to get on mainstream media, of course, the corporate media that's getting tighter and more monopolized and more restrictive for any outside information.
The live broadcasts are free to view and all shows are archived in high definition on YouTube. CCN plays host to a stellar team of broadcasters and producers, all of whom rely on the network to get their message and information out to the world. CCN has continued to evolve, constantly seeking to create greater media usage and opportunities for both broadcasters and viewers, including supporting projects such as the newly launched ConsciousCommunities.org, a brand new social media platform that is free to use and has been created for those dedicated to the pursuit of freedom, justice, peace, and sustainability to come together and co-create the solutions to a better world. Due to the constant heavy usage, we are in need of replenishing and replacing of key hardware and infrastructural wear and tear. This includes the fixing and replacing of parts of the live broadcast equipment system, as well as increasing storage capacities for content and projects. Without this, CCN and its affiliate projects will simply not be able to continue. Conscious Consumer Network is a publicly funded project, and it is up to you all to keep CCN on the air.